accession number 28698, Reel 4.
Major Lawton, Reel 4. Did you have a medical when you joined the forces?
Yep, we got one when I went to the recruiting office, and they sent it with a civvy doctor, and they do everything. And the only thing they found wrong with us was I had a weak right eye. I damaged that when I was a kid, throwing scissors at on the street to try and bust it to make two knives, and it'd come back and hit us in the eye. So I had to go to Catterick and have a proper eye test and everything else. And they said, they give us two choices, wear glasses or shoot left-handed. So believe it or not, for 30-odd years I shot left-handed. And the rest of the medical I was clear and fit and everything else. So.
Good medical.
Always good medical. Good medical. And of course then you get to the depot and then you have another medical. And believe it or not, it's like the old Bob Monkhouse black and white pictures. Everybody in a thing, everybody stripped off, you know, coughs, bloody do, and it really was like that, and but no problems.
And did you have some form of medical check-up periodically during the junior forces time?
Every year, you get what's called your pullings. Yeah. Every single year, you get your pullings.
Were you warned as young soldiers about prostitution and VD and this kind of thing?
Yes, well, again, it was part of the education, and they said you'll go to foreign countries, and you get told about malaria and all the rest of it, and then it comes down to the old VD and stuff like that. And every country we went to, Malaya, Singapore, Cyprus, when you booked out on a night time, if you had free time, you were actually issued condoms. Of course, in Malaya and in Singapore and places like that, we used to keep them anyway, because we used to use them for carrying water. Because it was an easy way, you could carry them in your top pocket, and then if you found a stream or something, of course, you could fill them up and use them as a water bottle, but never did use them for what they were meant for, but I had no problems either. But yes, you always got told, and later in life the medical corps used to come round and show you VD, and that had all gone wrong, so we got some fairly graphic lectures and photographs on them subjects.
Kidney inspections we haven't talked about. How often did you get kidney inspections in that first 6 weeks?
Oh, every week. In with your room inspections, and then of course you learn how to box beds. And you'd have your box bed inspection day.
How do you box a bed?
Well, it would be you'd lay one blanket out to the exact descriptive size, and then you'd put another blanket inside it, and then you'd put your two sheets to a descriptive size, then your pillowcases, and then you'd wrap your blanket round it. And then your last blanket would be as tight as a drum on top of your bed, on top of your mattress, and that would be all pulled in. And of course, it was all hospital bed style. So everything was tight in all the corners. Then you'd place your box bed on top, your box bedding, and that would be inspected. And the old coin, bouncing it off the thing to make sure it came up. And then you'd get into your locker, and everything was laid out again in 9-inch squares. Your shirts would be folded up 9 inches, and your trousers would be 9 inches, and your socks would be rolled up together and inside out, so it made a roll like that. And even your spare laces were tied up like the old licorice circles you used to get, round and round and round, and you had to bowl them and polish them, and they'd all be laid out. And then you'd have your red vest and your white vest, and then another red vest, and then your PT shorts would be laid out. And so you'd go up and down, and everything would be laid out in 9-inch boxes. Yeah.
You didn't have to lie down on your bed in the old traditional...
The only time you do that on your beds is, one, if you're told to, if they want to look at something in particular, the creases in your shirt or the creases in your trousers, or you're in the guard room. But no ordinary room inspections. Unless they would say, take your mess tins and your lockers and knife, fork and spoon out, and they would lay them down. If that was the particular mode of that day, and then you've checked, make sure there's no waste products of food inside your tines of your fork or anything. No.
Officers, didn't you come across officers on your training, in 6 weeks' training?
Yes, you did, but not so often. It was more or less the corporals and the sergeant. But your platoon commander would come and he would do the room inspection. Or he would come and give you a specific lecture, or they would talk about current affairs and how important it was that you must read a newspaper at least once a day, and you must write home at least once a week, and that was always left to the officers to tell you that.
Do you remember any of the names of the officers?
Well, embarrassing as it is, And it came on conversation, but my boss in Winchester now, Colonel Wickham, when I was talking to him one day about the foot and mouth disease, and he went, "Were you an angio platoon in 1967? I said, "I was." He says, "I think I was your platoon commander." And like I said before, I can remember all the sergeants, all the corporals, and most of the train staff. And I wasn't sure about my platoon commander, but I think it was Colonel Wickham.
What was he like?
Well, he was more for the political side of life and the welfare side of life and the inspection side. So but the basic training was done by the corporals and the sergeants.
Who was in command of the camp? What rank did that person hold?
A colonel. I know his name has just gone out of my head, but I remember the adjutant, who was Mike Bond, who you see at every daily reunion. He was our adjutant. And Harrington, who was a KSLI man, he was the RSM. And Bob Davies' dad, Joe Davy, who was very good friends of mine for a lot of my army career, he was our company sergeant major. So I do remember all of our staff.
I should have asked you, was there an official pay parade? How did you get your money?
Oh, pay parade, that was another way of remembering your number, rank and name, and drill, and discipline all tied up in one. Because again, you'd be lined up, and there would be the pay officer paying your payout with two escorts, and he'd call your number, rank and name out, and you had to march up in your smartest fashion possible, slam your tabs in, salute, receive your pay, and then you would salute again, say pay and pay book correct, hand your pay book in, take a pace back, and fall out, and then the next man. And if you didn't do any of your drill properly, or you didn't salute properly, or you said anything out of turn, you'd go back to the back of the queue, and you'd continue doing that until you got everything so perfect to get your pay. And then if you did owe any money to the barrack room damage people, then you'd fall out and go to another corporal or a colour sergeant, and you'd pay your 5 shilling or your 2 shilling or whatever damage you'd done. Yeah, that's how it was done.
I should have asked you, did you do route marches in
yes.
6 weeks?
Yeah, you did route marches, and believe it or not, that was the way of breaking your boots in. They would take it out 10 miles out to Wrekin Ranges, and then you'd have to go through certain villages and certain back lanes and countryside, and you would have to map read yourself back in. And they would assimilate, or assess rather, where you stood map reading wise. And then they would give you proper map reading tests. And that used to build you right up to your Army Certificate of Education 1, where it was, you know, your maths, your English, your current world affairs, and map reading.
And on these route marches, did you take heavy equipment on your back or any of that?
Not in them days. In fact, we didn't have heavy equipment in them days. It was the small pack. On your two D-rings on the front of your weapon, and you chuck it over your head, and you could hardly get anything in. I mean, the fact that we went around the world on several exercises in all kinds, and we lived out them small packs, makes me wonder how we used to do it in them days. But no, you had your small pack on, and you'd be carrying your packed lunch and your water and things like that. But you'd be given checkpoints to go, and you'd have to, the name of a pub at that grid reference, and how many windows and a house in the middle of the country, that, so it would make you zigzag through the country, and that was the way of learning us how to do individual route marches. And then the big route marches was the build up to your 10 milers. And of course you would then spend your 2 or 3 days field training at Nesscliff, which was 10 mile away. And then first thing on that morning you do your route march back. So it was your 10 miler as a formed up body of men. So you did your individual or pairs map reading and route marching, and then you do your 10 miler, and you'd all run and walk all the way back.
And an hourly rest period, was there?
No, it was 10 minutes within the hour. So you'd march for an hour and have a 10-minute break, then march an hour.
And that hadn't changed over many, many years,
has it? And it still hasn't changed now.
When were you allowed out?
After the 6 weeks training, and you had the passing out parade, or the passing off the square parade, and that's when you start wearing your beret with pride, and you were... Half a trained recruit.
You couldn't go out the camp for the first 6 weeks.
No. And then so you were allowed down to your local town.
So you finished with a passing out parade.
At the end of your full time training, you had the full passing out parade. That's when everything was bulled up, and it was everything that was put into place for your drill, your marching, your discipline and everything else, and the prize given of who'd been the most improved soldier, who the best shot, the best PTI, the best machine gunner, and the best overall soldier.
So, and there were prizes, awards, as you say, for those?
Well, there was awards. It was read out. It went on a plaque in the cookhouse of the... And then, of course, the overall best platoon. And that was all in the...
Do you recall where you came in this competition, the platoon?
Well, it might sound big-headed, but I should have gotten the best recruit. But again, I was only then, by 17 and a half year old, we had some people in who were 21-year-old, who'd been ex-Navy. And he needed a leg up in the battalion because he was older than the normal recruit going in. And they got me in the guard room and they said, Lawton, you are the best recruit, but we're going to give it to a guy called Nick Farrell because he's 3 or 4 years older and he needs to go into the battalion with this report. And that was fine. I also came second as the in the physical training side because with a little lad from Sunderland called Midge Douglas. He was football, daft and all the rest of it. And quite right, I might have put the most effort into it, but he was the natural footballer and sports person. So I came second in that. And I think I came second in the shooting and the machine gun as well. So,
was it a big parade with the band and everything?
Oh, absolutely. There was about three platoons passing out. And again, and it was a full-blown parade. Everybody on the band, the bugles, all the dignitaries. And I forget the name of the general, but the speech was, you know, you are now trained soldiers. And you stand there like oak trees, because it was a very windy day. And we all were bracing into it. And we got all the good words of encouragement that lasted me for the rest of my life, actually. Yeah.
So what happened next after your final parade?
Well, I would have gone a little bit leave. Then we had to come back to the depot, pick our kit up, and we'd been assigned battalions. Some people could go up to the battalion of their choice, and mine was DLI anyway. But at the time, because DLI was fully manned, you could only go if you had a family connection. I had no family connection, but I was so staunch that I was going to be DLI, I had no problem. So we picked our kit up and we went to Colchester, where the DLI, where they'd come back from Hong Kong and Borneo, were now stationed. And we were met at the station by the MT, who collected us all, jumped in the back of the Bedfords with our kit, and were taken to Miani Barracks in Colchester. And I was assigned to 10 Platoon C Company 1 DLI.
And what reception did you get on immediately appearing?
Well, that bit's a little bit of a blur, but I remember it was a case of, you're on the second floor, get up there, find a bed space, and it was the first one on the left by the door, which I found that's where all the rubbish got swept to in the end, but never mind. And again, there was lads in my room who had been injured in the ambushes in Borneo. But it was a well-mixed and well-operationally trained platoon. And again, there were 10-man rooms this time. And I got on straight away with them. Although at that time, there was people coming around the rooms. And these can be classed as bullies, I suppose. And they'd pin you in your bed with your white sheets and bash you on the nose with the bottom of your boots. Never happened to me, but it happened to other people who made the mouth go. I had no problem. I was just told, keep quiet, keep out of trouble. And
so these were people who upset someone in some way or other?
No, there was two or three guys, and they weren't in from our company, in fact. They'd come from another company, and they'd come in, and they'd get all the young lads in the beds, and they'd pin you down by holding the white sheets tight so your arms were stuck inside, and then the other one would come up and bash her on the nose. And there was other things going on which I didn't class as bullying, but they would say, right, young Lawton, have you got any money? And I said, well, I've only got enough to get myself a couple of pints. And then you see these lads downtown later, and they would say, I thought you couldn't come out, you've got no money. He said, oh, we've got some money, you've got no uniform. And you go back on the night time to find out your number two dress or your best boots or something had been put in the hock shop. But on the Friday, when these lads got the money, they got the pay, they go down and get your kit back out. So that happened. But I never lost any kit and was never ever stolen long term.
How was the battalion structured from the kernel down, you know, the various structure, various parts.
It's a normal, you had the battalion headquarters, and it was Toby Morn at the time. He was the, in fact, the last ALI colonel. And they were in the battalion headquarters at the top end. And then you had your A company, B company, C company, support company, and headquarter company. We also had an education block, which we used to call it where E company, but it was for people doing further education or doing pre-NCOs, cadres, or anything to do with education. And then you had your gymnasiums, your cookhouses, your church, and the guard room, of course, at the front gate.
So Colonel Morn was in command?
Colonel Morn was a commanding officer. A guy called Mike Benson was the battalion's second in command, and Ted Darwin was the RSM. And then you had your company commanders coming down the line. Mine was a guy called Major Ian Robertson. And David Lawrence was the company 2IC. And Eddie Duckworth, who just died this year, he was my company sergeant major.
What, in general, what backgrounds did officers come from?
At that time, all the officers, as far as I know, were Durham officers. They had been long-time DLI anywhere. And from this part of the country, up here in Durham. Later in life, of course, there was a lot of people educated in Durham University, but they weren't Durham men who commanded us. But no, a lot of them were homegrown Durham men.
Were they to a middle-class professional background? Or?
Yes. I mean, people like Windsor Aubrey and them, I think, were solicitors and lawyers in their former life. The professional men, and certainly a different class of people. And again, later in life, we found out you needed that class of people to make the final decision. Yeah. Some of them were a little bit eccentric in some of the things they did. I'll leave it at that.
your company commander, what was he like as a person and an officer?
Absolutely brilliant. Strict. Knew his business. Again, like most company commanders, unless he's commanding the company at the time on exercises or anything, you see very little of him unless you're in trouble and you march in front of him. Everything's really left to the company sergeant major and your platoon sergeants down over.
And your company sergeant major again was?
Eddie Duckworth.
And what was he like?
He was absolutely brilliant. Again, full chest of medals, done plenty of war service. I had done war service, I believe, and had been DLI all his life. Strict when he had to be strict, but a friendly word if you needed advice, as were the platoon sergeants as well. Mine was a guy called Wally Staniland from Hartlepool.
You've got battalion, various companies, they're divided into platoons.
Yeah.
How many platoons per company?
Three. I was in 10 platoon.
And then the platoons, were they subdivided?
And then they were subdivided into three or four sections, depending on how many men and what role you were doing.
How many men were in each of these?
Each section was a section of eight, and then a lance corporal and a corporal.
What was the size of the company?
Well, the companies were about 100 to 120 strong, and then they were broken down into three platoons. And each platoon would be 30-plus strong, and then the platoons would be down into four sections of eight men, and each with a platoon commander, platoon sergeant, and then your section commanders.
What was the weaponry now held within a...
Well, we'll still use the SLR and bayonet, the GPMG, although we still had some LMGs, and we still had the 303 and the sniper rifles. We had the Carl Gustav anti-tank gun, although we were still firing the 94 Nurger, which was a laugh, really, because I think you had to be up to 75 yards off a tank to do any destruction. But we still carried it, and we still were educated on its use and how to fire it. And then the normal Mills 36 grenade, the 9mm pistol, and we still had the 9mm submachine gun, the SMG. And that was really our armoury.
Good weapons?
I think so.
For the time, of course.
Oh, absolutely, for the time. And all effective, apart from the 94 Nurger, which was a bit of a joke, actually.
Again, what was the accommodation? Did it differ from your training accommodation?
Yes, it was. I mean, we still had the metal lockers at first. the bed space, there was 10 men to a room, or 8 men to a room rather, and your NCOs slept in bunks outside the main section room. Again, communal toilets, communal showers, but it was lino floors, which again, and instead of being bulled up this time, had to be cleaned and a light layer of polish on. And I even remember section commanders and platoon sergeants on inspection day would have the old razor blades taking any cigarette burn marks off and everything else. So it was still bullshit in the DLI in them days. And we still had locker layouts. We didn't box beds, but we had locker layouts still. And we had regular room inspections by the company commanders.
Was there any change in the discipline between the 6 weeks when you'd been under training and now as an effective professional soldier with your own battalion?
Oh, yeah. I mean, nobody money-coddled you anymore. You got up and you did what you had to do. You read company detail. You knew how to read company detail, so you knew where to be in the correct dress with the right equipment at the right time. And nobody was going to chase you. You were grown up. Going back to the six weeks training was only to the passing off square. After the 6 weeks training, of course, it was another 12 weeks or so for your full amount of training.
With the battalion?
No. In fact, going back to the depot, you did 6 weeks to pass off the square, and then you did really the rest of your training before going to the battalion.
This would be when you'd be firing the guns, etc.
This is your full range packets and everything else, yeah.
Which you've touched upon, but without really registering with that.
Yeah.
And at the end of that, how did you feel? Did you feel a professional soldier at the end of the 12 weeks?
Yes, I think we did. Although once the shock of getting to a trained battalion who hadn't long been back from Borneo and stuff like that, and people still carrying the wounds of it, but life was fairly busy, and it came in fits and starts because we hadn't been in the battalion long before we went to Cyprus for a 6 weeks exercise. And it was during the 6 weeks exercise that Colonel Morn, this was November December 1967, told the battalion that we would be coming back to Cyprus in 1968 as a UN battalion, and we'd be also losing the name DLI. It would be called 4LI, and we'd be coming back as Light Infantry.
We'll obviously come to that.
Yep.
Was there a name to this barracks in Colchester?
Yep, Miani Barracks.
Sorry?
Miani Barracks.
Miani Barracks.
Yeah. And funny enough, it was another Northern Battalion next door to us in Hyderabad Barracks, and both camps were joined together, and the square was shared by both battalions, and that was the Green Howards.
Did you get on well with them?
No, there was a lot of... Yes and no. There was a lot of rivalry between being two Northern battalions, and there was quite a few fights outside the fish and chip shop on the way back to the barracks. And like most garrison towns, pubs were frequented by the DLI, and other people, anyway, didn't want to go in, or didn't go in. And the Green Howards had a different part of town, and that would be frequented by the Green Howards, and different parts by the artillery and different parts by other units. Everybody did drink in each other's pubs, of course, but you could sometimes guarantee at the end of a night, especially on a weekend, there would be some rivalry and there would be a fight on the way back to the barracks.
Just basically part of the course, wasn't it?
Yeah, part of the course. The garrison, Colchester, was heavily patrolled on night times anyway by the regimental police of the individual units and the Royal Military Police. So it was really little catchment areas like the fish shop or a certain bar where a fight would start. But apart from that, yeah, we exercised together and we got on together in normal life. We would even go to their camp if you had a spare travel warrant or you wanted some money for travel warrant. Said, anybody else going to Durham at the weekend want to buy my travel warrant? And they'd buy your travel warrant. Highly illegal, but it happened.
Could we, again, go through a typical day in the life of the battalion that you were involved in?
Well, again, there was still a certain amount of drill because we knew we were going to be doing disbandment parades and stuff like that. And there was still quite a bit of bullshit in the DLI. And there'd be times where you'd be made to sit on your bed for a whole afternoon, again, doing your brasses, pulling your boots, pressing your kit, boxing your great coat and things like that. And again, in between, there was, again, we had no conflicts at the time, believe it or not. And so a lot of time we would be playing cards, reading books, and catching up with your own welfare. And then, of course, we did the 6 weeks exercise in Cyprus. And by the time we came back from that, we were really preparing for disbandment and moving up to Barnard Castle.
So you'd done your firing of all the range of weapons in this 12-month week training following the initial 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And now you're into a full battalion there. Did you still continue with weapon training on that scale?
Oh, yeah, but that was up to your section commanders then. Because every year you've still got to do your annual personal weapons test and your annual personal shooting tests. And we had Middlewick Rangers down the road. And again, we'd march there and we'd march back and we'd do all the shooting down there. And we used to go on the assault course very regular in the daylight. We were always on the assault course. So that would be a half a day job. But we'd march everywhere we went. So Middlewick Rangers was 10 miles, we would march there and we would march back and or get the lorries back or get the lorries there and march back. But one way or another, it was all physical and the assault course all the time. And then we went to Thetford training. Believe it or not, we knew we were going to the jungle in 1969. So we would do training in the jungle, even if it was in the middle of the snow. And we'd go to Otterburn to do our big range shoots and live firing exercises as a battalion. So we travel all the way from Colchester to Otterburn.
What ranges did you fire at in your practice?
Well, the normal rifle ranges were all at 100, 200 and 300, and the machine guns going back to 600. And you always kept it the middle distance shooting. The snipers would obviously go further and further back to 800 or even 1,000. And they were still using the old 303 sniper rifles. And the anti-tanks were wombats and combats, and of course the 81mm mortars, which changed from 3-inch mortars to 81mm mortars. And then the cargo staff people would use the anti-tank ranges for the cargo staffs.
So again, you'd have mortar platoon, was it? A mortar?
Oh yeah, they had a mortar platoon, an anti-tank platoon, pioneer platoon, and the recce platoon. So they were individual platoons within support company.
Oh, they were part of support company?
Yeah, they were all part of it. So you had A, B and C were the rifle companies, support company were all the support weapons, and headquarter company were all your Cooks, Clerks and quartermaster department.